You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Live from Chickentown, this is the Flopcast, episode 621.
On flopcast.net.
Yes, yes, hello, Mayor.
Hello, Kevin.
The Mayor of Chickentown.
I'm back again.
Back as a guest host again. Yeah, Cornflake has the week off. Cornflake's busy, but that's okay. We'll get through this somehow. We actually had a plan in mind because we had something that we've been meaning to talk about, which is so ridiculous and trivial and 1970s themed that we thought Cornflake doesn't want to deal with all of this.
Right. Better to rope in the mayor for this one.
Yes. Well, we did a show a few weeks ago. The title of the show was Super Chick Rabbit Hole, which was in reference to Super Chick from the Croft Super Show.
Yeah, but that was only the very beginning of the rabbit hole. We went way down that rabbit hole.
We'd just begun to go spiraling down the Super Chick rabbit hole. So yeah, that we were talking a little bit about the Croft Super Show because a lot of Croft shows are streaming now, which is very exciting for the likes of us.
We've been watching a lot of the Croft Super Show.
Got way into Croft Super Show. And yeah, Captain Cool and the Kongs was the band that hosted Croft Super Show, including Super Chick was one of the members, which is where that episode got its title. But yeah, there's so much you can go into about the Croft Super Show, and even specifically about Super Chick, about Debbie Klinger, who was the young woman who played Super Chick. And it was just interesting when we started looking into her career because she intersected so many different aspects of pop culture and show business throughout the 60s and 70s and into the 80s.
And some very specific things to us.
A lot of stuff that is of interest very much to weirdos like us.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And so we thought we could actually kind of build a whole conversation around the career of Super Chick, of Debbie Klinger, because she did so much. And we'll kind of build up to the Croft Super Show.
Sure.
And I think this is going to be a two-parter. I don't know if part two will be next week or if we'll pick it up sometime later, but we'll figure that out.
You, the fans, are demanding to get to the end of the Super Chick rabbit hole as soon as possible, then maybe we'll do it next week.
We'll figure it out. But yeah, there's so much to cover that I thought, just so it doesn't go too long, we're going to split this in half. We're going to split the Croft Super Show right in half. So I think the plan is we're going to work right up through season one of Croft Super Show, and then next time we'll pick it up with season two.
Okay.
So to start, going back to Debbie Klinger, young Debbie Klinger, born in 1952, and kind of got into show business in the 50s,
yeah.
I think, as a little kid, because this all starts with a group known as the Klinger Sisters.
And that was Debbie and three of her sisters.
It's the four Klinger sisters, and they were a barbershop quartet.
Yeah, that was an odd way to start out.
Yeah, yeah. How do you feel about barbershop quartets? Because a lot of people feel that they're a big problem.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I like a cappella.
Right. And I think the modern a cappella,
yeah.
Whereas the old timey,
yeah,
you know, the striped suit jackets and hats and canes, and that's where it can really get to be an ordeal.
Yeah, there's a barbershop quartet wandering through The Music Man, the movie of The Music Man that you encounter now and then.
Okay, I haven't seen that. It's a problem when they show up?
No, it's not. I mean, it's pleasant enough when they show up. And then there's also, you know, Buddy Hackett's running around.
I saw a whole barbershop chorus once.
Wow.
So not one of your modern, like, college-style a cappella groups, but this was, like, a bunch of guys, like dozens of guys, 100 guys or something, all wearing the matching costumes and, you know, big gray mustaches and whatnot.
That's kind of scary.
They'd all kind of tip their hats at the same time, like they were choreographed, and there were literally like 100 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, Rockapella is a four-man a cappella group that is definitely not a barbershop quartet.
Oh, yeah.
I think I prefer them.
Rockapella from Carmen Sandiego.
Yeah, they were on Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
I remember them. So Debbie and her sisters were a barbershop quartet, and there were a lot of parallels with the Osmonds, including that they were working directly with the Osmonds.
Yeah, before too long, I think.
But the Klingers, that this was a Mormon family in Utah, so they were in the neighborhood, and you know, same timeline, essentially, that they were coming up at the same time. The Osmond boys, the Osmond brothers, you know, pre-Marie, were a group as well, worked with the same vocal coach.
Yeah.
Back then, and worked together, did perform together, did shows together. So they were in that same circuit way back in the like late 50s or early 60s, certainly, and got on TV early, as the Osmonds did. But there's video. You can see the Klinger sisters as kids. I mean, and Debbie was the baby of the family. She's a little girl. And they're on the Andy Williams show.
Yeah.
You'd see them all together. Here's the Klingers and the Osmonds on TV together.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes.
Absolutely. But yeah, Andy Williams show. And then the Danny Kaye show, they did a lot of.
They became regular guests on the Danny Kaye show. And Danny Kaye sang with them. It wasn't just the girls by themselves.
They'd be there singing with Danny. Yes. Danny Kaye comes up a lot, or you know, used to come up a lot on the Gilbert Gottfried podcast, because they had all the old-timey show business people would come on. Sure. And they'd, whenever the subject of Danny Kaye would come up, nobody liked Danny Kaye.
That's too bad. I have fond memories of the Hans Christian Andersen movie and the songs he does in that.
Oh, a classic old-timey show business performer, but apparently a monster off screen. Nobody got along with him.
Yeah, that's too bad.
He seemed to get along fine with the kids, though. He seemed to be nice around the kids, I think.
One would hope so.
I don't think the Klinger sisters had a problem with Danny Kaye. But yeah, so they were on, you know, these national big TV shows as little kids. And then the mid-60s, here comes rock and roll.
Yeah.
And they saw what was happening. They could read the writing on the wall. They could tell Everybody Hates a Barbershop Quartet, as I do.
and even kind of the kids group singing on variety shows was probably kind of passing out of
That's got to dry up at some point. You know what America wants to see? Just little Mormon children harmonizing. Something's got to give. And the Klingers saw that coming. And this was their idea, I believe, was that the Klinger sisters said, let's turn into a band. Let's be a rock band. And they did.
Yeah.
Their father bought them instruments. And as Debbie tells it, like, she's the youngest. She was the last in line to pick an instrument and ended up on the bass by default, which was fine, though. She became a fine bassist. But they were, if not the first all-girl rock band, which arguably they may be, but certainly among the very first. They're certainly in the conversation.
Right. People tend to credit the Runaways, and the Runaways actually, you know, had a recording career, whereas the Klingers didn't have much of one.
But they did, though. I mean, they did. They were signed to major labels. They were recording and releasing singles. So they were very much a very busy, working, active rock band, and several years ahead of the Runaways.
They deserve to be better known.
They really do. They kind of got a raw deal in show business as a band, as a rock band. Because they were kind of on the cusp, on the brink of really being a big band. And just that's how it goes. You know, so many bands we never hear of because most bands are not hugely successful.
Right.
That's how it goes. We can't all be the Sponge Awareness Foundation, you know?
There can only be one.
There have to be some little obscure, pathetic bands that nobody knows or cares about. The Klingers, as a rock band, again, they were on TV. They were still getting booked on these national TV talk shows and variety shows. The Smothers Brothers, they appeared on, you know, big shows like that.
Yeah.
They were scheduled to have their own TV show, like a summer replacement series, while the Smothers Brothers were on break.
Yeah. This is kind of the biggest tragedy.
Yeah, and that's what happened is the Smothers Brothers got canceled, and then the potential Klinger show got canceled right along with them. But it's one of those things, like, they were so close. You know, what if that had happened? That would have been a game changer.
Right. And it seems like the Klingers and maybe Debbie Klinger particularly had more near misses than a lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, sure. And I mean, compared to most bands, of course, they were quite successful. Most bands did not get on the Smothers Brothers.
That's certainly true.
They opened for the Righteous Brothers on tour. They played with Gladys Knight. They appeared with Bob Hope. They went on American Bandstand, Glenn Campbell's TV show, I think. So they were doing all that.
Yeah. So many variety shows back in the day.
Everybody had. I mean, they were about to get their own show.
Yeah.
You know, the Starland Vocal Band got their own variety show. Everybody got it.
There definitely should have been. We should go back in time and kind of pull the strings and make sure that did not happen to this for the Starland Vocal
they
Band.
They were tossing
for the Clingers instead.
Tossing variety shows out to everybody. You can hear Clingers music online. You can hear all those singles that they released and a lot of their TV appearances. There are YouTube clips. They sounded great. They were cool. Obviously, you know, they were harmonizing as little kids, so they had the harmonies down.
Yeah.
Peggy Klinger, I believe it was Peggy who was the keyboardist, she could wail like Janis.
Yeah.
Like she had a strong lead voice, and I think they would all take turns singing lead on different things as well. There's a couple of Beatles covers.
Blackbird.
They did Blackbird. They did Good Day Sunshine, I believe. All those clips are out there. On one of their singles, they did Gonna Have a Good Time Tonight, which I knew from the Lost Boys.
Oh.
Many, many years later. Oh. That's the song that INXS and fellow Australian Jimmy Barnes cover in the Lost Boys.
Okay.
The Clingers did that as well. They were not the first to do it. I think like the previous year, it was I looked this up. It was an Australian band called the Easy Beats did that song originally. Not a big hit in America,
right.
I think. Yeah, the Clingers kind of fell apart for various reasons. They had poor management situations. They had record label issues, you know, all kinds of the typical problems. It was all happening to them.
Yeah. And they were spreading their own wings, and yeah, they were teenage girls.
Yeah. And then meanwhile, you know, one of them went off to get married, I think. So they were kind of relocating, and one of them formed a duo with another guy, like a songwriting duo. Mm-hmm. So they were breaking apart, doing different projects. And as the Clingers, it never really took off. They just started doing different things. So it kind of fizzled out.
Mm-hmm.
Peggy Klinger, the one that I think it was Peggy with the Janis Joplin wailing voice, she co-wrote songs for the Partridge Family did.
Oh, yeah.
Donny Osmond did one of Peggy's songs. Cher did a Peggy Klinger song. And here's a fun credit, because we're going to get into Debbie Klinger, of course, got involved in kids' TV and obviously in kids' projects, but so did Peggy. Peggy wrote songs and was a singing voice on a Hanna-Barbera show, The Chattanooga Cats, a largely forgotten...
it's a cute name. I never saw it.
That would be very early 70s,
okay.
I think. And yeah, it was like a hillbilly cat jug band kind of a thing. And they hosted a cartoon, and there'd be other cartoon segments as part of it.
But okay.
Chattanooga Cats. And Peggy was the singing voice of one of the cats. Debbie, meanwhile, was doing backup singing on recordings for people like Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
Helen Reddy, Don Everly from the Everly Brothers.
Yeah.
And she also mentioned in an interview, Precious and Few, old song by Climax.
Yeah.
Not I Miss You, Climax from the 80s,
right.
with a K. Climax with a C from way back in the 70s. Debbie is singing on that monster hit song, Precious and Few.
Wow.
Which I could not escape as a kid. Yikes. Whatever kind of easy listening 70s radio stations we had on.
Sure.
Precious and Few. How many key changes are there in Precious and Few? Like 11?
I'm not as familiar with the song as you. I certainly heard it, but I don't think I've listened to it all the way through.
You keep thinking they're done, then they take it up a key and let's go around again.
Normally I like a key change, but there's such a thing as stretching it out too long.
Yeah, I haven't listened to Precious and Few in a few decades, but as I recall, bursting with key changes. So here's where it gets fun, though, with Debbie Klinger. Debbie was part of two fictional bands for kids. Croft Super Show was the second one.
Yeah.
And this is something more in your wheelhouse than mine, but Debbie was a member of a band called the Rock Flowers.
And yeah, the band was represented in doll form. Mattel made these. And they had like hippie flowery costumes, and they came with a 45.
Yeah, so this was a band, like the real band that Debbie was in, was put together just to support the toy line.
Yeah.
Right? This was created, let's have a band to do the songs, do the music. And they would actually make public appearances as well, like in character, in costume.
Yeah, they had flowery names, right?
Yeah, yeah. They were named like Iris and Heather and Rosemary, names mm-hmm. like that. I think they went through a few different names. It was a trio, I think, that Debbie was a part of, although I think there were more doll names. But yeah, you can see them on album covers or single covers or things, pictures of Debbie with the other girls like in costume.
And they have 2 albums worth of songs that you can find on Apple Music.
There's also, I found a commercial for Rockflower dolls.
Oh, cool.
It's astonishing.
I need to see that.
Little girls in hippie clothing dancing around playing the record. Playing Rockflower's record.
Yeah.
And the dolls, mm-hmm. the Rockflower doll itself had like a little notch or a little hole in the foot so you could stick the doll on the middle of the record player.
Uh-oh.
And the doll would spin around while the record plays.
All right. I think the parents might have had some complaints about that if the dolls came loose and broke their record players.
Every record player in all those fancy 70s hi-fi systems destroyed by the Rockflowers.
Yep.
In the commercial, though, it's just little girls. They're dancing around all dressed up like the dolls. The dolls are spinning on the record player. And narrating the whole thing is Casey Kasem.
That's bizarre and yet seems right somehow.
It's a fantastic commercial. Yeah, one of the Rockflower songs evidently reached number 95 on the charts.
Hey!
Yeah. So that's Debbie's fictional band number one.
Yeah.
We're big fans of fictional bands around here, of course. You know, we participate in the Dragon Con Classics Track Battle of the Fictional Bands tournaments.
Absolutely.
At least once or twice a year.
I know, that's our perennial favorite.
I don't remember if Croft Super Show has ever been in one of the battles. I don't know.
I don't know. If you didn't bring it up, I don't know who.
I feel like they would do well in a Battle of the Fictional Bands. But so Debbie could compete twice.
Yes.
Anyway, so that was Rockflowers. Now, let's jump right up to 1976, the Croft Super Show. So we are massive fans of all the goofy old kiddie TV shows of mm-hmm. Sid and Marty Croft. You know, they were puppeteers and puppet builders and got into TV. They made the costumes, the puppets and suits for the Banana Splits for mm-hmm. Hanna-Barbera. That was like 1968. Then 1969, went into business for themselves. Sid and Marty Croft Productions, H.R. Puffin stuff.
Yeah, so they've been in the Saturday morning TV business quite a while when they put together the Croft Super Show.
And it was the early stuff was that psychedelic, hippie, freaky era. And it was Puffin stuff and Lidsville and the Bugaloos, which we've been watching some Bugaloos lately, too. Another fine fictional band.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Bugaloos. We love the Bugaloos. And then they started branching out after that. Well, there was Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, and then the real game changer was Land of the Lost.
Yeah, that as a kid, that was the only one that I was aware of, and I liked it a lot.
It was the best.
It's definitely, they had real science fiction writers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Aspects of it look ridiculous.
Of course.
Still, it was on a budget, and it was mid-70s, and the effects were not always the best, but such smart writing for the time for a kid show, especially.
Absolutely.
The Marshall family, you know, mm-hmm. trapped in the world of dinosaurs and Sleestaks and Pacuni and such. We love it. So after that, then they kind of took even more of a science fiction turn mm-hmm. at Sid and Marty Croft. They did Far Out Space Nuts.
Yeah, that's not good.
Gilligan's Island in Space.
Pretty much.
That was Bob Denver and Chuck McCann taking up the skipper role, essentially.
Yeah.
And astronauts lost in space, mm-hmm. if you will, and just having goofy adventures. And then meanwhile, simultaneously, they did Lost Saucer.
Yeah, that I'm becoming quite fond of the Lost Saucer.
Lost Saucer, which is also streaming. All this stuff is streaming. And yeah, I loved Lost Saucer as a kid just because it was the androids wearing their shiny, sparkly android costumes.
Yep.
That's all I cared about.
Easy way to get Kevin's attention when he was a kid is to put sparkly, shiny stuff on the screen.
Yes, little colored lights flashing on and off. Evidently, all you need to entertain me. And in some ways, to this day, that is still the case. But yeah, that was Jim Nabors and Ruth Buzzy as androids in shiny, sparkly android suits. And they were just tumbling around in a flying saucer mm-hmm. with a Dorse.
Yes. And the Dorse is credited as himself.
So the Dorse was a dog-horse hybrid creature. So those two shows came out simultaneously, I think. If I have the timeline right, that was 75, I think. Mm-hmm. 1976, now we're up to the Kroft Super Show. And this was a big, ambitious project for the Krofts because this was like an anthology series. Yeah. It was long. Originally, I think it was 90 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And the idea was Kroft Super Show, and we'll have a rock band hosting this show and introducing various segments. So Kroft Super Show, your hosts are this rock band, Captain Cool and the Kongs, and very glam rock-looking, sparkly costumes.
Yeah, really kind of over the top. And they had like sparkly makeup on their faces and crazy wigs.
They looked incredible. Again, I like sparkly things. So to run through the band, we'll build up to Debbie.
Sure.
But to get through the rest of the band, we have Captain Cool himself, your leader of Captain Cool and the Kongs. That's Michael Lembeck. Who comes out of a show business family. His father is Harvey Lembeck, who was an actor and a comedian. You remembered Harvey Lembeck from Beach Blanket Bingo.
He's a recurring character in those movies where he's like a biker.
The Frankie and Annette beach movies of the 60s. Because, we watched Beach Blanket Bingo a while back, which is really the only one I've ever seen.
Yeah, but he's a recurring character in that series. He apparently keeps coming back. He's ridiculous.
The antagonist biker gang leader dude, just in the big goofy cap and the leather jacket and such. Yeah, Beach Blanket Bingo, that's the one we watched because that's the one with Marta Kristen as a mermaid, as Lorelei the mermaid. And Buster Keaton is wandering around for some reason.
Yeah, let's not get off track.
But this is all relevant.
Yeah.
I assume that's the best beach movie, and so I never bothered with the other ones.
That's what I hear.
Harvey Lembeck played that same character in many of them, and this is Harvey's son, Michael Lembeck, now is your leader, Captain Cool. Before this, as far as nerd credits, here's a big one. For Michael, he was in the TV version in 1975 of the Superman musical. It's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman.
Oh, man.
Yeah, which is awfully ridiculous.
It is.
We have seen it. That's something you got to see to believe. The Superman musical. He wasn't Superman. He didn't have a big part in it, but he was in there. Michael Lembeck, post Kroft Super Show, he was in On the Right Track, the Gary Coleman movie.
That's right.
Had a big part in that one. Mm-hmm. We like Gary Coleman movies.
we've gone off on a lot of weird tangents lately.
Gary Coleman made a lot of TV movies, but On the Right Track was in movie theaters. Yeah. That was a movie with Michael Lembeck. Absolutely. That was Gary Coleman lives in a subway station.
A train station. Train station. In
a
locker.
He lives in a locker in a train station. And he can pick the winners of the horse races. Mm-hmm. That's the wacky premise. His big credit as far as an actor, Michael Lembeck, and what I absolutely remember him from was One Day at a Time. For several years, he was a regular on One Day at a Time. Not an original member, but a few seasons in.
He marries Mackenzie Phillips, right?
He marries, Julie, played by Mackenzie Phillips, the older daughter of the two daughters on One Day at a Time. Uh-huh. He was Max. Okay. He was a pilot or a navigator. He was an airline guy, so he'd always be off on flights and stuff.
Did he still have the long hair?
No, he doesn't have the... He should have just shown up in full Captain Cool mode.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd recognize him with that.
He had a beard.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Had a full beard going on One Day at a Time. And not much of a character to him, as I recall. Like he was just a guy.
Yeah.
They just needed a guy to just be a nice, normal type guy.
He was no Schneider.
I guess the hope was that he'd be a stabilizing influence on chaotic Julie Mackenzie Phillips. But so they were married on that show. So he was there for several years of the run of One Day at a Time. When he got out of acting for the most part, eventually, and became a director, and a very successful director, mostly sitcoms, done a ton of sitcom directing, Friends, and a lot of sitcoms. Okay. And I think to this day, he still is very busy as a director. But he was Captain Cool. Now we got Turkey.
Turkey. Ridiculous name, ridiculous character, ridiculous looking.
On the drums is Turkey, played by Mickey McMeal. And they tried to make Turkey the goofy one in the group.
They would make a lot of turkey sounds accompanying his antics.
Yeah, and he was a big, tall guy.
Yeah.
Towered over the rest of the band. And they just tried to play him off as the big, goofy dude. Huge mop of hair, giant, long, curly hair. And Mickey McMeal had very few acting credits outside of being on Croft Super Show, but he was a real musician. He was a real drummer. He was a drummer in a real band. He was not an original member, but in the mid-70s, probably like just before Croft Super Show, for a while, he was the drummer in Three Dog Night.
Oh.
What were the big hits of I always get mixed up over which 70s band did what. What did Three Dog Night do?
One is The Loneliest Number.
Right. Were they Joy to the World?
Joy to the World is.
Okay. I feel like they had a few that I know. But Mickey, you know, who's soon to be known as Turkey, was an actual drummer for Three Dog Night. So that they were hiring real musicians to be in this band. I mean, I don't know how accomplished a musician Michael Lembeck was. You know, I guess he could sing and apparently play some guitar.
Yeah.
I don't know that he had a lot of music credits going into this, but he was certainly, you know, had the acting comedy background and pedigree. But Mickey was Turkey. His big acting credit that I believe caught your eye was one of your very favorite movies, apparently has a little part by Mickey McMeal in it.
Yeah, Xanadu.
He's in Xanadu. His IMDb page says The Accountant in Xanadu.
I have an idea of who he might be. He might be one of the guys who hassles Michael Beck at the beginning.
Michael Beck, who you've heard here on the Flopcast.
Yes. People
from Xanadu. So Xanadu was 1980. That would have been a couple years post Croft Super Show. And that was really it for acting, though. Mickey did not pursue acting, so I guess he kind of quietly went back into the world of music, but I don't think has done anything really high profile since then. Let's look at Nashville.
The other girl in the band.
Other girl. There are two girls in the band. Three guys, two girls. Nashville also had kind of big, goofy, curly hair, and they kind of played her up with the
Southern accent.
Southern accent, I guess. Yeah, I guess it's a Nashville accent, I would imagine. Louise Duarte played Nashville.
She played keyboard in the band, right?
She's, yes, the keyboardist in Croft Super Show. Again, now how much real keyboards can she play? I'm not sure, because I don't know that she has a lot of music credits outside this band. But she is very accomplished as an actor and as a comedian. Mm-hmm. And an impressionist.
Yeah.
She does like shows, like one woman shows and stuff, and and has done a lot of, and you see her do impressions on some Croft shows. When eventually they got to the Bay City Roller Show, you know, she was still around and did a lot of impressions and characters on that.
Yeah, she and Turkey both pop up.
Yeah, and she's done like Barbara Streisand and Cher. She does an amazing Cher impression, and so she can do a lot and still does.
Cool.
And you know, a lot of cartoon voice work as well, of course, as you would imagine. So she worked a lot for the Crofts, I believe, both before and after Croft Super Show. That was Nashville. And then finally, we have kind of the lost, forgotten member of Captain Cool and the Kongs.
Yeah.
That's Flatbush. Because season one only, we had a fifth guy in the band, Flatbush, played by Bert Sommer.
And yeah, Bert is no longer with us.
Yeah, Bert died young, I think in early 90s. Bert was, like Turkey, Bert was a musician more than an actor. Although, he did musical theater as well before this. So he was in Hair.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
I believe on Broadway, even. Like, not an original cast member, but along the way, sometime in the late 60s or so, he was in the Hair cast.
I can see that.
And the amazing credit on Bert Sommer, who was an accomplished singer-songwriter, musician, was releasing albums. Mm-hmm. Nothing really broke big commercially, but Bert Sommer played at Woodstock.
Yeah.
Early on, he was the third performer on the opening day of Woodstock.
Yeah.
In 1969.
It's incredible to go from Woodstock to Croft Super Show. And he probably thought that himself, and maybe that's he didn't stick around for the second season.
In the middle of Croft Super Show filming, he was thinking, I was on stage at Woodstock. Now I'm covered in sparkles and feathers and in my crazy glam suit with my hat. He did a full set at Woodstock, 10 songs.
Yeah? Wow.
He received the first standing ovation at Woodstock.
Hey!
The hippies got up.
That's pretty good.
Off the filthy ground to applaud for Flatbush. Among the songs he performed at Woodstock, this is going by Wikipedia, I believe, he did a song called Jennifer, which was inspired by a fellow Hair cast member, Jennifer Warnes.
Oh.
As in, I've had the time of my life with Bill Medley.
Yeah.
And I mean, she did a lot, you know, the right time of the night, and she did a bunch of stuff. But yes, Jennifer Warnes was with Bert in Hair, and he wrote a song about her and played it at Woodstock.
That's you just keep learning things.
It's crazy.
The Super Chick rabbit hole drew us into a bigger rabbit hole than we thought.
Well, that's why, yeah, I feel like, you know, Super Chick is an excuse to look at all these branches that stretch out from the Kraft Super Show. So now we haven't addressed Super Chick directly yet. So Super Chick, obviously, played by Debbie Klinger.
Yeah. Was she your favorite in the band?
Of course she was my favorite.
She's cute.
She's Super Chick. And again, season one, which was the glam, sparkly season, she had the glitter heart on her cheek.
Yeah. And kind of, she's styled not unlike Marie Osmond, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. They definitely did a lot of pairing off. Of Captain Cool and Super Chick during the songs in a way that looked very much like Donnie and Marie.
Mm-hmm. And the Osmonds wrote the songs for Captain Cool and the Kongs in the first season, at least.
Yes. Yeah, they wrote a lot of Captain Cool songs and a lot of the theme music for the various segments of Kraft Super Show.
Yeah. What's great about the first season is that the credits and the interstitials with Captain Cool and the Kongs are at the long-lost, fabled indoor theme park that the Crofts put together.
Yeah, this was 1976, so they got this in that very narrow window when there was the World of Sid and Marty Kraft amusement park in Atlanta, Georgia. It was only around for a few months. It was a financial disaster, and it was closed immediately. And you know, we've talked about that theme park, of course.
I'm
fascinated by the Kraft theme park. They sent Captain Cool and the Kongs out to Atlanta to shoot everything. All the Captain Cool segments for season one were all shot in that theme park.
Mm-hmm. Not with kids there.
No, I've got to assume that they shot at night or they shot when it was closed because you very rarely saw people there. Once in a while, there were one or two scenes, I think, where they'd actually have an audience that you could see. But usually it was just them and the it just looked like it was dark and quiet all around them. I think they did a lot of night shooting. But so little video exists of the World of Sid and Marty Kraft that it's kind of a treasure that they did shoot those Super Show segments there. And I wish they'd shot more. I wish they'd shown more.
Yeah.
Because they never even said where they were.
Right.
I mean, you could kind of see that, like, the opening credits, the opening theme to the show, they're outside and marching, leading children in a parade, heading down the highway into downtown Atlanta, like The Walking Dead, approaching the World of Sid and Marty Kraft. I know Debbie said that probably Marty Kraft arranged, like, they shut down traffic on the highway leading into Atlanta.
Oh, I hope so.
So they could shoot that scene with the band and a million kids following them down the street. But those shots inside the Kraft theme park, it was mostly like tight shots where you could just barely see what was around them. And I'd just be fascinated. Like, what's that over there? Where are they now?
Yeah.
And there'd be like a giant robot behind them. Just these crazy Kraft theme things that were just in the background. One of the rides in the park was the Crystal Carousel, their big merry-go-round. And it was all these crystal animals. And they shot a scene or two just like standing in front of it. Or maybe even I think they actually got up on the rides a little bit. But they weren't even running.
Right, yeah.
There was no wide shot. They didn't show you the whole carousel. It was a tight close-up. You could just see a little tiny piece of it.
Why didn't they show it off a little more? Maybe it was already a big loss.
Well, one thing I know is that the rides were constantly breaking down. So they probably were afraid to turn them on. You know, when in the morning it would have been, oh, those weird TV people broke all the rides last night. Sorry. So yeah, they never got to ride the Crystal Carousel on camera or the pinball ride.
Yeah.
There was a ride where, like, you get inside a giant pinball and then ride through a whole thing like you're in a pinball machine. And they didn't use that. I think there's some scenes like at the entrance to that ride.
Okay.
The escalator they used a little bit. And that's the only thing that's left.
Yeah.
The escalator's still there.
Yeah.
The building eventually became CNN headquarters.
Yeah.
And it's right next to the aquarium and the World of Coca-Cola and all the super touristy stuff is in one fun neighborhood around Olympic Park in Atlanta. But they did shoot at least one or two like comedy segments with the band where they used the escalator.
Yeah.
Like Turkey has to go running up and down the escalator.
Yep.
So yeah, for Kraft theme park fans, it is a gem that they have those sequences shot there. And then there's performances. You see the Captain Cool and the Kongs performing all their wacky little rock and roll songs. And then they throw to the segments. Now, segments, season one, it's Wonderbug.
Oh, man. Wonderbug is rough.
A lot of them are kind of rough to get through. Wonderbug is the dune buggy that comes to life. Mm-hmm. It's Schlepkar, a beat-up old dune buggy.
Which is voiced by Frank Welker.
Frank Welker just makes the weird grumbling car noises as Schlepkar. And these kids, our three kids, they find a horn in a junkyard. They stick it on on Schlepkar, and then it magically transforms into Wonderbug, which can fly and is super intelligent and
has all sorts of gizmos and gadgets that gets them out of trouble.
Yes, that's Wonderbug. And it's the two guys and the girl.
Yeah.
And they're running around having wacky adventures. Guest stars on Wonderbug included Sid Haig.
Mm-hmm. He's pretty recognizable.
Yes. Oh, you cannot miss Sid Haig. And he shows up in a couple of Kruft things. Mm-hmm. Avery Schreiber showed up. We were a fan of his from the Match Game. Mickey Morton is in a Wonderbug episode.
Mickey Morton is our hero.
Mickey Morton. He's playing a guy named Mr. Big. They just needed a big, scary-looking guy. And this is a giant man. But yeah, we keep running into Mickey Morton credits everywhere we turn. Mickey Morton was Mala, Chewbacca's wife, in the Star Wars Holiday Special.
And Solomon Grundy in Legends of the Superheroes.
Yes, of course. Solomon Grundy as well. The Wonder Woman episode that we all watched together at Dragon Con last year.
Oh, the gorilla.
And performed in with the gorilla. Yeah, Mickey Morton is the gorilla. And many other things. We've seen him on the Monkees. Mm-hmm. Pops up all over the place. Just a giant guy that got every role where they needed a giant guy.
Yep.
So fun guest stars on Wonderbug. It's a awfully ridiculous little show, though. But we got through it. Mm-hmm. Dr. Shrinker.
Yeah, I can't decide which one is worse, Wonderbug or Dr. Shrinker. I feel like Dr. Shrinker has a few more redeeming qualities.
Perhaps. I would agree. Yeah, I mean, I love them both, but I grant you there's some problems with both of them. Dr. Shrinker, it's a mad scientist who invents a shrinking ray, and these three kids come poking around. He shrinks them down, so they're like 6 inches tall, and now they're running around. He's trying to catch them. They're trying to escape.
Right. He wants them because to prove that his invention works, so he can make lots of money.
The premise makes no sense at all.
I know.
But
his sidekick, though, is Billy Barty.
Yeah.
And he's great.
Hugo, played by Billy Barty. And Billy Barty was on like every Kroft show.
Yeah.
They used him in everything.
Right, because he was usually in costume as a little person.
Yeah, this was the only show where regularly his character was out of costume, just Billy Barty. And you get to see, yikes, he was a great performer.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, most of the time when he's in a full like Sigmund costume or a Lidsville suit or whatever they dress him in, the Firefly on Bugaloos, you know, his remarkable performing ability does not really shine through the wacky costumes he was always hiding inside. So, yeah, really fun to see Billy Barty on Dr. Shrinker. Guest stars included Gordon Jump.
Yeah.
A couple years before WKRP. Mm-hmm. There's Gordon Jump on Dr. Shrinker. That was fun. The other star that really showed up was Clint Howard.
Yeah, Clint Howard's brother.
Credited as Wild Boy. They just found like a wild kid that, you know.
Yeah, was raised in the jungle.
Yeah. And sort of hinting at what was to come.
Yes, yeah.
In Kroft Super Show Season 2. But that was Dr. Shrinker. Awfully ridiculous. They did show Lost Saucer, which had already been its own show previously, but they put reruns of it into the Kroft Super Show as well. And then most importantly, Electro Woman and Dinah Girl.
That's really the gem.
Yeah. Yeah. Our superhero duo, of course, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, played by Deirdre Hall and Judy Strangis.
Yeah, each of their adventures was a two-parter, so there would be a cliffhanger.
But yeah, we loved Electra Woman and Dinah Girl back in the day. You can hear me break down every episode of Electra Woman and Dinah Girl in excruciating detail, along with our friend John Drew on the Batcave podcast. Mm-hmm. Links to all those shows are on flopcast.net, I believe. And yeah, yikes, we dissected that show like no one ever has before
or
ever will, I think. So there's an important service to the world that we provided.
But we did learn one important fact about Electra Woman and Dinah Girl.
Oh, yeah. Very relevant to today's Debbie Klinger-themed show.
Of course it is.
Super Chick show. The theme from Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, and I was not aware of this when we did all those podcasts about Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. The theme, it turns out, was sung by Debbie Klinger.
Yeah, she's not credited.
This changes everything. We can plug where we got this information, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a podcast called the Pop Culture Retro Show, and Deborah Klinger was a recent guest on that show. So that's where that revelation, revelation came to our attention. Yeah, there's Debbie, the voice of the Electra Woman and Dino Girl theme. There was just a autograph show, like a celebrity autograph thing out in Los Angeles just a few weeks ago. And among the guests were Electra Woman and Dino Girl.
Yeah.
They had Deirdre Hall and Judy Strangis were there together. I saw some photos of it. Yikes, they look amazing.
That's terrific.
There are pictures of them together smiling, which is just amazing, you know, 45 years later or whatever.
Wow.
And I also saw photos of that event. There's a guy that went to that event. Electra Woman and Dino Girl had the Electra Comps. They had those big electronic devices on their wrists.
Yeah, like a wrist computer that they could communicate with Frank. Yeah,
it had lights and buttons and a video screen and all this stuff on it. And a guy came to meet them at this autograph show, and he had built Electra Comps.
Yeah.
And I mean, they look as good, if not better, than the ones that were on the show.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they look better.
He built one. Well, he built a few of them, but he presented an Electra Comp to each of them.
That's so cool.
Deirdre and Judy. And there's pictures of them with their new. And these are working Electra Comps.
I mean, as well. Working as in how? As in they make sounds.
They
and
have
press the
sounds
buttons.
And lights and video. You can see video of Heflin, their assistant, speaking to them. And you can see video of the villains when they would appear on the video screen at Electra Base.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is pretty astounding.
Some kind of mad genius is out there building actual working Electra Comps.
Okay. We need to commission some for ourselves.
I think he's selling them on Etsy or he's selling them somewhere.
Okay. But
they are not cheap.
Yeah.
Nor should they be.
Maybe.
It's a working Electra Comp.
Maybe I should save up for that. We'll call it the Mare Comp.
So those were the segments on Croft Super Show, anyway, for season one, all anchored by Captain Cool and the Kongs, of course, featuring Super Chick, Debbie Klinger, who provided this kind of look through show business of the 50s through the mid-70s. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a long way to go.
Yeah. Because there's another season of Croft Super Show.
Yes, this is we've reached where I thought we were going to stop today, so we're going to stop today, and we're going to pick this up and do a part two of this Super Chick deep dive. Because, yeah, Debbie touches so many things that we are huge fans of. You know, Mattel dolls.
Yeah.
You know, you're a big Barbie fan, Barbie expert. Croft Super Show, Saturday morning TV, music. And we've got a long way to go because Debbie, there's a whole other season of Croft Super Show to get through. And Debbie's going to get into a lot more TV and movies and cartoons and all kinds of stuff to get into. So we shall do that another time soon. But for now, that's enough of a Super Chick exploration.
We saturated you with Super Chick.
That's plenty. If anybody's still listening, let's wrap up the show.
Okay. Well, you can visit flopcast.net and see all of our show notes and links. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/flopcast, on Instagram at @_flopcast, on Mastodon, universidon.com/@flopcast. Music for the Flopcast was written and performed by the Sponge Awareness Foundation.
Yeah, and if you want to throw on a Sponge Awareness record, Ed and I will come to your house and stand on top of the record player and spin around for your amusement. Happy to do so.
Yeah.
All right, Mayor, thanks for joining me for the Super Chick Deep Dive.
Absolutely.
Part one.
Well, we've been living it.
That's true. It's all we talk about or think about anymore.
You had to share it with someone.
Thanks for hanging out with everybody. And of course, please be safe, be kind, be silly, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Drew Leiter here, inviting you to join Cletus Jacobs and I every week as we dive deeper into the dawn of DC. We review DC comics, television, movies, and more. We're excited to finish the final season of Doom Patrol, return to Sweet Tooth for its second season, and check out the Netflix series Bodies. Get all your DC news on the Earth Station DCU podcast, part of the ESO Network.
Okay, secret after show. This already ran longer than we thought it would, so here's a super short secret after show. For the secret people,
okay.
A little preview of what's to come on Super Chick Deep Dive, part two. I'll leave you with just two very important words: Rankin Bass.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.